Welcome to Disgraced, a podcast by The Awkward Silence. Each of the people we interview in this series has peeled back the yogurt lid of fame and licked the tasty recognition inside. So how, we ask them, did they then manage to get their tongue stuck for so long that they were asked to leave the shop? This is a podcast about success. This is a podcast about failure. This is a podcast called Disgraced.
Hello, you.
Hello, Rob. Have a good evening.
In this episode, The Awkward Silence, speak to The Awkward Silence.
It's great. It's been fun, hasn't it?
Yeah. We've spoken to some legends. We've heard some stories, some wacky tales, haven't we?
Wacky tales. Some really, really horrible people.
Some really upsetting stuff, yeah. I certainly left the whole thing sadder than I began it.
I'm so great that you say that. That's definitely one of the main things that I take away from it. And I hope the listeners have as well, just that sense of despair, kind of the faith in your fellow man.
That feeling of profound loss.
Mm. And it is our fellow man, isn't it? Because it has been all men.
Yes, and it's mainly been one fellow man. It's been Simon who's been listening to it. Simon, the listener, made it clear he would only listen to it if it were exclusively men. So
that was. Okay.
Yeah.
God, he's picky, isn't he?
Yeah, I don't know if you realise we've been catering our material to him quite substantially over the years.
Oh, okay, because you kept saying... Right, because genuinely I thought this was a game that you would do. You kept saying, Simon says, we have to do the show like this. And I could go, again, your little jokes. But you genuinely meant Simon had told us.
Yes, that wasn't... I can see that would have sounded like the game Simon said. Yeah. No, this is Simon Trevelyan. He's our number one fan. He's our one fan. And the reason we're a double act comprising two men is that he made it very clear he wouldn't get on board if we weren't just men. And to be honest, at the time we needed all the fans we could get. So I said, I'm happy to oblige, Simon. And I ripped up the contract I was writing for the third member who was a woman, and she never joined our group, which is a shame.
I've always wondered what happened to her. She was great.
Catherine Tate, I think her name was.
I remember. Did she keep it up? Did she stick with the comedy or?
I don't think without us, I don't think she did much really. No, she auditioned really well. It's just as soon as Simon said, I want it to be 100% men, I said, Catherine, you've got to go.
Well, that's fascinating because I did always wonder why you went for me. Because, of course, I never... we met while I was studying classical civilizations at a prestigious university. I never did comedy. As I remember it, we met in a museum.
Yes, well, I mean... It would have seemed like a chance encounter to you, but I'd been sitting in your lectures for quite some time by that point, and I was sitting behind you, directly behind you, for 6 or 7 months, just getting a feel for you.
Right, okay.
You know, I've always said comedy is 80% about the back of one's head. So I would spend a lot of time just walking around, looking at the backs of people's heads. Lecture theatres was fantastic for this. In retrospect, I shouldn't.
You weren't studying there at the time, were you? You were, as I remember it, you were kind of busking.
I was busking with my harp and a small dog who would join me in the chorus of whichever song I was singing. It was a good time. I was earning more. In fact, I was earning more than I've ever earned. I was earning £60,000 a month. I mean, it was extraordinary.
Why you gave that up?
No, well, the dog being run over was quite a sort of pivotal point for me, I think, because
How did Jeffrey went to a farm?
No, he was hit by an Audi.
Oh, well, that's the worst car.
Yeah, that led me to pursue my interest in comedy, and I started looking around for the backs of people's heads, as you do, you know. And I saw you walking into one of the colleges, and I remember just laughing out loud. I just thought, he's doing something very subtle there with the back of his head. Some of the funniest material I think you've ever done. Oh. And so I was studying you for a while as you were, you know, having lectures and things, and even seminars. I was looking through the windows.
The windows are high up.
Yes. No, I was briefly a window cleaner. Because it enabled me to gain access to some of the higher windows.
I do remember some of the seminars were interrupted by a window cleaner with a massive moustache. I assumed he was just a flagrantly Italian man.
Oh, no, that was a colleague of mine. Yes, no, he's...
That wasn't you.
No, that's Vincente. He is a very good window cleaner. No, I wore a dress in order to conceal my identity, and you would never have seen me, I think.
I don't remember that at all. Fascinating. You put quite a lot of work into it. Because as you say, the first I knew about it, we were there at the museum, and you bumped into me with a big box of nuts. I was standing there looking at this statue of Aphrodite. You just bumped into me and just kind of went, "Nuts!" And that's the first thing I remember you saying to me. Yeah. Nuts! And they'd gone everywhere at that point. It was just covered in them.
They'd gone everywhere. And do you remember the first thing you said?
Was it the name of a god? I seem to remember it was one of the gods. It was Vulcan.
What you said after the 10-minute silence, it was almost like a sort of duel, you know, this staring match we had. You actually said, "By the power of Zeus, yes, yes, yes." And you said yes three times. And we shook hands there and then. And
I remember there was a very warm feeling. Yeah.
Well, yes, you'd urinated into your trousers. That was probably the warm feeling. And I joined you just in solidarity. So we were stood there both peeing freely. And do you remember the staff shouting at us as we were leaving? And they said, "You've got to pick up those nuts."
Yeah. And what? And what is that? And what else is that all over the floor? What have you spilled? That better not be.
Yeah.
That better not be what we think it is.
It very much set the tone, didn't it, for the partnership?
It did. There was a lot of laughter. There was a lot of, I think that's really typified a whole relationship. A lot of laughter, a lot of nuts, a lot of piss.
I think some people would call those the three pillars of comedy.
The nuts certainly always carried through. I mean, although we used to do the gigs in London, we used to travel down on the train together, but we lived in completely different cities. And
I was living in Inverness, yeah.
You were, yeah. So you'd set off like the day before. But I remember, you know, we used to have run our own nights. So the first one we did was Armand and Jones and Acquaintances.
And then we said it was too long and we just called it Splash Time.
Splash Time, yeah. So we were doing Splash Time, and all these great comedians turn up to work with us because we'd paid them. Every time we met anybody new, every time it was time to greet somebody, I'd turn around and you'd be there in the corner, just hunched over a box of nuts, a box of like greasy nuts that you picked up from some local nut house. Yeah, here's Ralph. Oh, yeah, meet Ralph. And you just kind of, you'd have your hands just covered in nut grease. And you always shook their hands. I remember that, still chewing on the nuts. I remember being quite, like really, really embarrassed for you and for them and for myself every time that happened.
That's interesting, isn't it? Because my memory of that is very positive. I don't remember feeling your embarrassment there, and I think I was so immersed in the nut experience that I assumed everyone was as happy with it as I was. But yes, yeah. I would extend a pair of greasy hands, and whether it was Chubby Ray or Laurie Wilkinson or
Laurie Wilkinson, what an amazing, just such a way with that gerbil.
Yeah,
you remember that first gig, and Laurie's like, "What's that gerbil for?" And he said, you'll see." And
you'll see.
Oh God, we did.
I mean, you just don't think it. You don't think in advance that it's going to travel that high.
It's well worth a watch.
We started booking, I suppose, more conventional acts after that. Slappy Ray and the Two Bad Boys. Milky John. Remember Milky John?
Yeah, not one of my favourite acts, I have to say. Mm. I know a lot of people liked him, but he just didn't do it for me. It was the smell.
Well, I think the thing about Milky John is he would have been to more people's taste if the milk he used was fresh milk. I think a lot of the problems he encountered were due to the fact that he used 7-week-old milk. And he said, I won't have it any other way. And I said, "Milky John, I respect that, but you will have to stay after the show and help us clean this up."
Yeah.
He never did.
And I think, you know, we moved on from that kind of gig about as quickly as we could and kind of really got involved in more sort of long-form stuff, didn't we? Because we were doing just the odd sort of 10-minute set of little vignettes. And I think we focused a lot on chip-based humour, the way I remember it in those days. You know, I don't think it's unfair to say that we got like a little bit stuck in that naval, that nautical rut.
I've always thought, and I didn't realise this at the time, but it took me years to work it out, but I think it was at least partly due to the fact that I lived on an enormous boat.
You think that was an influence?
I think it must have been, because I remember thinking, where's all this stuff coming from? You know?
Yeah.
And I had to look deep inside myself, and I looked out of one of the windows, and we were just coming into port at that point. And I thought, wait a minute. I live on a boat. Yeah. And that was when it hit me. And from then on, I think as soon as I realized that, it became forced, and we migrated away from ship stuff. And we really began to experiment with other forms of transport. We did.
Because, I mean, I remember, because we were still doing short bit. We were trying to mix it up. But I remember you came to me one day and you said, Simon said, we have to do longer gigs. Yeah. I remember you said, we're going to write a three-hour show.
Yes, the three-hour show. Yes, I mean, it was ill-advised to go from 10 minutes to 3 hours in such a short space of time, but that was what Simon wanted. He called the shots, and he still does in many ways. The 3 hours, though, were some of our best work. Oh, they certainly included some of our best work. I mean, your stuff with the cherries, I still think it's one of the funniest things I've ever seen.
I'm so pleased to hear you say that. It was just, you know, one of those things, because I tried it initially with light cheese and it just didn't.
They're not buoyant enough, are they?
They're not, and they're just not funny. You look at light cheese, cherry. That's it. That's exactly the right size and shape for humour.
For what you wanted the cherry to do, I think it was perfectly custom made, almost.
Absolutely perfect. Very difficult to recover the cherries afterwards.
Well, you wouldn't want to, really, would you?
No. It's fair point. You've got to eventually for medical reasons. But yeah, it was. I think that was really good. And it was really good to be able to incorporate that kind of humour into the longer form shows. And I think our first full length show that we took up to the we took up to the Fringe Festival of the Arts, didn't we?
Yes, the Fringe Fringe, yeah.
Fringe, yeah, and we've been wanting to do Fringe for just ages, and really thinking, you know, this is the year we're going to do Fringe. Everybody does it; it's where you've got to be. But we finally had the requisite 3-hour show, because they insist for Fringe that you can't do less than 3 hours.
Can't do less, can't do more. That's what they say. Yeah.
No, and you're there, and you're looking like you might finish at sort of 2 3/4 hours, and the venue staff are looking daggers at you, like, no, keep going. You're there in the field. It's all field-based.
Al fresco, yeah.
Yeah, anyone who hasn't been, any of the listeners who haven't been to Fringe, you must go. It's simply the best.
You must.
2 months of your life.
Well, that's if you only go for the beginning.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. Well, not everyone can commit to the full half a year. But, and the mayor of Fringe is there every day, geeing people on, going, come on, do your shows, keep going, because it's a 24/7 thing.
Yeah,
you do about like 3 performances a day of a 3-hour show, and the rest of it you're just handing out, you know, advertising material.
That's right.
Inside of hay bales, which is difficult. People don't want to take hay bales. It's like, oh no, I've already got. You know, they always do that, don't they? It's like, oh no, I'm already carrying too many hay bales. I've already got one of your hay bales in my bag. Yeah.
It's like with hay bales. It's like, well, I can see you're not carrying 2 hay bales already.
Yeah, you know, come on.
You'd be able to see them. But I think that first show, I mean, without that, we wouldn't have been signed by Neville. He wouldn't have offered to represent us. And without Neville, and without the backing of the agency, I don't think we would have got the larger gigs that we then got. You know, we started.
Badgers Run the World was the turning point. This, if anyone hasn't seen it, it's a show about the secretive cabal of badgers. They actually run the whole of the post office in this country, and then various other things. In other countries, it's all very funny. But you know, badgers really made it for us, and Neville just brought us on to heights we couldn't have hoped to achieve.
No, I remember he said, I'm going to make you stars. I'm going to make you big. I'm going to make you huge.
He actually made us a couple of stars, didn't he, to wear?
Yeah.
The tariffs of comedy.
He said, I'm going to make you some clothes. And we said, Neville, it's very nice of you, but we have, thanks for the stars, but we've got our own clothes. But, you know, that's Neville for you. He's always got plates spinning.
Every pie, irons in every fire.
And we did, in retrospect, we did the O2 very early on in our career. And I remember Neville sorting that booking for us and saying, you know, you'll be supporting Westlife. And I remember thinking, you know, this is good. I mean, don't get me wrong, Neville, this is good. I remember looking at you and thinking, how are Westlife fans going to take this? You know, two guys doing what was scheduled to be a two-hour support slot. You know, how are the Westlife fans going to take it? And
because Westlife, I mean, sorry, again, anyone who doesn't know Westlife, they've got a pretty big following, even now. And we have, and I never quite realised this, but I perhaps should have guessed, looking back on it, that we've only ever actually had one fan, and that's Simon. So, yeah, you're absolutely right. Yeah, how were they going to react to a support slot from who will have had one supporter there? And that's if he could make it.
Well, he insists on not coming to the shows. He likes to, he arranges for someone to film these gigs and then he watches them in private afterwards. You know, he's never actually attended one.
Oh, I thought we were just filming them for you, for your own private entertainment. Right, you were passing a lot is coming out now that makes a lot more.
He's never seen a live show of ours. You know, he's never seen it live. But that gig, despite Simon not being there and therefore 100% of the audience being there for this Irish pop band, it went astonishingly well, I thought. You know, we were cheered on and then cheered off very shortly afterwards because we only managed to do 15 minutes of our 2 hours before. I think there was a problem with the lights, wasn't there?
We much of the show did rely pretty heavily on quite a complex light routine.
And even though it was the O2, even though it was Westlife, they didn't quite have the technical capacity. So when we were in the midst of one of those particularly complex routines, one of the lights burst and we were plunged into darkness. People assumed that was the end of our set and they cheered us off. And in retrospect, I think that is probably as well as it could have gone. We did, you know, we did about a tenth of the length of time that we were supposed to. But we were pretty much the only thing people spoke about that gig, I think. We were in all the reviews.
Good looking.
No. I mean, I think it was because they were performing with very compromised lighting after that point.
It was completely pitch black, and I think some of the lanterns had perhaps damaged the electrics, so no one could hear them. I'm not sure if anyone realised they'd come on.
I think a lot of people left very early and wandered off in the dark. That meant we were, you know, we were booked for these TV slots, and we did funny buggers on ITV4, didn't we?
That was horrible. Everyone, because you know, all the people we were working with, such big names, and they seemed so sort of starry and unapproachable. But the really interesting thing about it was, as soon as you were there with them in the room, they were just nasty, really, really unapproachable.
Well, I think we probably invited a little bit of that ourselves because we were very arrogant, I think, at that point, and we had been riding this Westlife wave, as we called it.
Yeah.
And we said, I think we probably didn't help things by saying, you know, that's how we introduced ourselves in the green room. Hello, everyone. We're the funniest two men you're ever going to meet in your whole life.
And I remember we'd rehearsed that, yeah.
Well, to say it at the same time. And
with quite long pauses.
Where we would just wink. We would wink during the pauses. And I don't know. I think that probably rubbed people up the wrong way. And that certainly with... I know Carol Vorderman did a brief thing on that show. Certainly with her, I remember thinking, we're getting very bad Vorderman vibes here, very bad Vorderman vibes. And I think she made it very clear very early on. She certainly didn't like me. I think she had a bit of a soft spot for you, but...
In a way, that was worse. That was worse. I think I'd have preferred the death glare that she gave you. But no, I do remember she gave like a good 10 minutes one of those episodes, just ripping into us, it became complete kind of roast. It was supposed to be about tensions on the Indian-Pakistani border and the Kashmir, but
it was, and it was live, which I always thought was very risky. But it meant that once she'd started on this rant about us, she didn't pull the punches.
Just no one could stop her. And I don't think anyone was trying. They were just staring at us and laughing. And I think we put a pretty good, pretty brave face on it. And in a way, all of this exposure didn't do us any favours, if we're honest, because they brought us to the attention. I know we've had Simon for all this time, but there is one other person who has enjoyed our work and has been with us for some time, kind of in the background. That's Lord Craven.
Yes, we had to bring him up at some point, I think. We were booked, weren't we, to perform at his mansion.
That was yeah. We just got this note, didn't we, delivered to the bard where we were living at the time, and this just very very slender, very soft voiced man came up to us and said, "I bear a note from Lord Craven. I can't do it. It was a horrible soft voice, and it just said mansion, night, and he wouldn't explain what it was. We had to work it out."
Mm. And it, well, when you turned it around, the full address was on the back, wasn't it? And
we did work it out quite quickly. Yeah, the information was all there. He explained what he wanted us to do.
It's just a case of turning over the paper sometimes.
It really was. Yeah, and I think possibly the guy didn't leave so much for effect as just he assumed. And we went there to Craven Towers, and it was, if you had to pick an adjective for the scene that greeted us when we went through those doors,
I think I would go with wet.
Oh yeah, indescribably wet. Yeah, but I mean, Dionysiac. Thank you. Yeah, sorry, I was going to say sort of excessive, hedonistic.
Yes.
Orgasmic, and yet somehow restrained. It was a horrible sense of kind of intense, suppressed, bacchanalian license. And he was there, wasn't he, in front of the great marble staircase? There was the man himself, and we didn't know what he would mean for us.
No, he was splayed across the floor, wasn't he? Like a lover waiting for you to come to bed. He was beckoning with this claw, wasn't even his.
No, just this dismembered claw, and he was vast, this heap of pallid, quivering flesh, just all that wine dribbling through his moustache.
And he rolled, you know, as if down a hill towards us, stood up. I remember him grasping you with wine-stained fingers and lifting you fully into the air and saying, "Follow me."
I didn't have any choice. I couldn't. My feet weren't touching the ground at this stage, and he just sort of led me through to the ballroom. And you just had to follow, didn't you? Because the crowd were kind of pressing in from behind.
Yes, there was. I was suddenly aware of a throng of people at my back. This was the Craven Collective, the people who do his bidding. And he made it very clear very early on that we were to perform in the middle of this circle, this improvised circle, while people indulged in all sorts of, the most depraved stuff.
Actually, it was the worst. The worst element of it was the ordered stuff. Some people were just playing cards. I think I saw one man doing his taxes. He was just filling in his VAT returns, and that in a way was worse. The party lasted for 3 days, and we were there performing everything we'd ever written, and some stuff that we just made up on the spot because we were not allowed to stop performing. I think we did Badgers, we did the French show 3 times.
No, at least I remember thinking we were doing it when the sun rose, we were doing it when the sun set, and then we were doing it when the sun, Lord Craven's son, arrived. So that at least 3 times.
Oh my God! And that was something else entirely. That whole tone of the thing changed at that point. But we couldn't. I couldn't really see anymore. I hadn't slept.
The thing is, you and I were very much hoping this would be a private gig, take the money and run sort of situation. And we were hoping by the end of the 3-4 days that we were there, we would just be able to have a bath together and forget about it. But
that was the only thing thinking about by the end was that bath.
The salty bath we have after every gig. But instead, do you remember we just spotted the flash of a camera and then a figure scuttling off?
That was his son, wasn't it?
And that was his son who we would discover worked for the Daily Mirror. So we crossed our fingers and we hoped for the best. We got on the respective trains after having our joint bath, and we went home. And then do you remember the following morning? Do you remember the headlines?
I mean, I just didn't understand why this was his paper. I don't understand why he ran with that story. I suppose because it didn't. No, it didn't mention him at all, did it? That was the
problem. It was an undisclosed location, a private individual, and the only faces that were visible in these photographs were ours.
Everyone else was blurred out. All these bits of people, you could tell what was going on, but no one was recognizable.
The faces were the only things that were blurred out. I mean, it was a very pornographic scene otherwise.
I remember it looked worse in the photograph than I remember it looking at the time, and I remember it looking like one circles of hell.
And in fact, that was in the subhead of the piece. It was described as giggle boys indulge in depraved circle of hell, nighttime fun time.
Yeah,
it was one of the worst sentences that I've ever
heard. Written, but you know, who cared? They were laughing it up, and we couldn't get a gig. We couldn't get arrested. We couldn't get arrested. We did get arrested.
We did. We got arrested immediately. I remember Simon texting me just three letters, WTF, and I knew then we disappointed him. I later learned that he didn't mean what the fuck. He actually meant where's the fun?
Oh, that's a shame. That's a shame. So he just wanted to know when the next gig was.
Yeah, he was saying where's the fun? Where's the next gig?
That's all right. We've got him back now. He listens to the podcast. It was Lord Craven. He was very pleased, and he made his feelings known. He started leaving his notes. Really, it's been like that ever since, hasn't it? You know, we'll meet up and we'll be having a nice drink and reminiscing about old times, and then, you know, you'll turn over a beer and that, what is it? We know it's Craven. He's been there. He's done something. We won't know what it is. There'll be a scorpion in one of the pints, or just everyone there will actually be working for him.
Or worse, all the people there are somehow Lord Craven.
I don't really sleep very well anymore. Because everything in my room could be Craven.
You could lay your head on your pillow, could be Craven. Put your foot in your slipper, could be Craven. And that's what he wants. You know, that's where he's got us now, and he knows that he can always go back to those photos and he can always drag it up and tell the media another sordid tale from that night. And now we're living in his greasy pocket.
Because we've been doing this podcast recently, because I don't think a lot of people realize this, we haven't left our homes for about a year now. Not since the last messages that we received. And this has just been a way to keep ourselves sane.
Knowing that any wrong move will trigger the wrath of the Craven.
So that's really, you know, we've been talking to all these people. It's been a lot of fun. We've had some good interviews, but we'd love to be doing our shows again. We'd love to see the outside world. We'd love to see our families. We'd love to be free.
And if only we hadn't read that note, if only we hadn't taken the drive, I think in a way, you know, life would be a lot simpler if my dog had never got run over by an Audi and I'd been forced to give up busking, because I was earning £600,000 a year.
Look, it's been great talking about the old days. Really fun to catch up.
So lovely to catch up, and if we ever make it out of our houses, then I hope to see you in the flesh at some point.
We'll have a bath.
Have a bath.
Just like old times.
Well, take care and be safe. Yeah.
Watch the shadows.
All right. Take care. Bye bye.
That was Disgraced, a podcast by The Awkward Silence. That was the last episode in the series, but if you missed any, do go back and have a listen. They're a real giggle. Leave a review if this episode tickled you, and as always, if you'd like to find out more about The Awkward Silence, visit theawkwardsilence.co.uk.